Welcome to a special supplement to the usual weekly 300 to 350 show, where we give you the opportunity to hear the rest of our interview with Oliver Tickell, architect of the Kyoto 2 scheme. So sit back and relax for the next 40 minutes while we explore the scheme in more detail. How would it be policed? How does it compare to contraction and convergence? What would its effect on coal use be? Might the scheme emerge out of a combination of a reformed EU emissions trading scheme and Barack Obama's US cap and trade system? Would it create a market in carbon? And if so, how would that work? And what would its effect on the economy be?
I mean, the overall aim of Kyoto 2 is to stabilise greenhouse gas emissions at not more than 350 parts per million. So this recognises the kind of James Hansen's recent findings, which also obviously we've been championing on this show, and the show title is indeed 300 to 350 show, which also implies that actually that James Hansen's work actually suggests that the stabilisation target should be somewhere between 300 to 350 and possibly at the lower end. But contraction and convergence could also conceivably be updated, and maybe they've already updated it to include such a target.
Well, I think that both contraction and convergence and the Kyoto 2 approach have in common that they propose structures and frameworks, and you can plug different figures into them. I personally accept what Jim Hansen has to say, which is that greenhouse gas levels are probably already too high, and I say that because we're starting to see positive feedback processes kicking in, especially in the Arctic, which have the potential to considerably amplify the warming pulse that has been created through greenhouse gas emissions. So if we accept that levels of greenhouse gases are already too high, then over the long term, we really need to bring them back down lower than their present level. And it seems to me that 350 parts per million from the current 385 or so is a reasonable target. And it may well be that we need to bring them lower after that. In a sense, many of these long-term targets, and these are really long-term targets because it'll take us quite a long time to get down to 350 ppm, but I think that we need to have that in mind, that the important thing is to generate actions now to really reverse the entire direction of the global economy, which has been and continues to be to consume more and more fossil fuels, and actually put it into reverse as far as that goes, and to rebalance the entire global energy economy towards renewables and conservation. And the precise numbers, the precise targets, and the precise levels that we reach can, in a sense, follow. The essential thing is to be taking these actions now and to be doing it in a very serious way.
Looking at the system of contraction and convergence with tradable energy quotas or personal carbon allowances, so that's the kind of international framework combined with a national framework of carbon rationing. That has the advantage of encouraging behaviour change and carbon consciousness. But that could also be encouraged by the carbon price, which would be handed on by Kyoto 2 to the consumers.
That's exactly right, yes.
Now, there's a couple of questions about that. One is, how fair is that in terms of the consumer? Because in terms of carbon rationing, you're kind of able to trade your credits, so it doesn't penalise the poor people that use small amounts of energy and are energy thrifty can actually get a financial benefit from that. But in a kind of more of a straight price signal that Kyoto 2 would deliver, that would hit the poor more.
I have to agree that it's important to bring about a system which does not cause the poor, who are suffering already from high fossil fuel prices, by adding yet further to the financial burdens that they face. And this is one reason why I think that these measures need to be complemented by considerable spending programs on energy efficiency, including energy efficiency programs in developed countries aimed at poor people. So in that way, poor people benefit by having the quality of their homes improved so that they are wasting less energy and they can enjoy greater thermal comfort while at the same time paying less for it. Now, the problem arises because it might be some years before the benefit comes through, and there is a potential in the intervening period for poor people to be hit by higher prices before they get the benefit of those spending programs. And so there may be a case for some kind of transitional arrangements in order to benefit people like that. It's actually very difficult to target money at the fuel poor, but I certainly think it is something that needs to be investigated. In the long term, of course, everybody benefits from a system in which we are no longer at the mercy of fossil fuel producers. And a large part of the economic pain that this country is feeling at the moment is actually the result of high fossil fuel prices, which has caused inflation, which has caused huge amounts of money simply to leave this country. And so the benefit of switching over to renewable energy sources and no longer being at the mercy of an international oil price, that is a huge long-term economic benefit, and one that countries such as Britain should be investing in heavily right now. As far as tradable quotas go as a system for rationing emissions, I think that this approach has one big advantage, which is that it makes people much more aware of how their behavior relates to carbon emissions, whether it's by flying or consuming electricity or gas. So I think that that awareness is an important thing. For me, the big problem is that it requires a major identity system that needs
I think I'm right in saying in your question and answer section at the end of the book, you do say that if a country did decide to introduce a system of personal carbon allowances or tradable energy quotas or whatever system is introduced, that could be compatible with an overall international Kyoto 2 framework.
Certainly compatible, yes. I mean, countries can do what they like. And if a country was to unilaterally take on a national cap and apply it through national quotas, then that would, broadly speaking, be helpful in that it would tend to limit global demand for fossil fuel permits.
What kind of carbon price are you envisaging?
Well, I think it's important that you don't have a carbon price which ever gets too high. And the reason for that is that although some people might say, oh, well, a very high carbon price is great because that's really going to drive changes. Well, yes, but all of this needs democratic consent. And as soon as you get to the point of having a carbon price, which is actually painful, the democratic consent that is needed for this system will begin to be undermined.
But presumably as the cap tightens, as the supply of fossil fuels is restricted in order to achieve the very low level of global emissions, the carbon cost and the cost of the permits must rise substantially, and that will be passed on to consumers as the scheme develops.
I think that as far as that goes, it doesn't necessarily have to rise very high, because remember that you've been spending all of this money in an accelerated program of emissions reductions. You've been building a renewable energy economy. You've been investing in energy efficiency. You've been reducing emissions from kind of other industrial sources. You've been investing in keeping biospheric carbon in forests and ecosystems and soils. So you're already seeing quite a big drawdown of greenhouse gas emissions and an enhancement of sinks. And in particular, as the renewable energy revolution takes off, what I would hope is that the renewable energy technologies deployed on a large scale become so much cheaper than they now are that they get cheaper than fossil fuels. And anybody wanting to develop a power station would simply rather put up solar panels on roofs, a concentrated solar power station in the Mediterranean, or an offshore wind farm, perhaps, that these technologies will take over from fossil fuel for the simple reason that they are cheaper. And therefore, the demand for fossil fuels can actually decline as a result of that whole dynamic of that process of change that has taken place in how the world's energy economy works. Now, if we succeed in doing that, then the carbon price, although it may go up, it doesn't necessarily need to go up to very high levels. But let's just imagine that it does go up to very high levels, but that by that time, perhaps, 80% of the energy that we were getting from fossil fuels is now produced from renewable energy sources. In that case, your carbon price can actually go up quite high, but because the world is using so much less carbon, because it is so much less dependent on fossil fuels, that higher carbon price is going to cause much less pain.
Okay, so it's a balance of supply and demand, and you're kind of assuming there that the demand for fossil fuels through decarbonisation of the economy, the pace of that will outstrip the pace of the constriction of supply needed to deliver the 350 target.
You are not depending on your cap and your carbon price alone. You're also depending on your regulations for energy efficiency, backed up by a major international spending program and the renewable energy revolution that is being kicked off.
So you're auctioning off permits to pollute upstream, as it were, as near as to production as possible. But during the auction, you have a floor price and a ceiling price, so that there isn't a massive fluctuation in the price, that the fluctuation is limited by those two, the ceiling and the floor. But one thing that concerns me about the way you've currently constructed your scheme is that the cap on emissions in any particular year is not a hard one. You have a system whereby you can borrow permits to pollute from future years. So that actually would increase pollution now and greenhouse gases now and make the system much tighter later, when actually it would be preferable in terms of delivering a 350 targets if we made those cuts earlier.
It would be preferable to make the largest possible cuts as quickly as possible, but it'll take some years before the investment program in energy efficiency and conservation and renewable energy starts to produce results. What we want to avoid is having price spikes in the permits which would cause pain and which would ultimately not prove very helpful to anybody. And so I think that the theory here is that you have a reserve price, you simply do not sell permits at less than a certain price, and that's in order to generate at least a minimal level of investment to spend, for example, on forests and on adaptation. Up at the top level, where you hit the ceiling price, then you simply carry on selling permits at the ceiling price until there is no longer demand at that price. So potentially you're selling quite a lot more permits in a given year than you originally intended to. Now, the point there is that you're selling them at quite a high price, and you have to make sure that you're selling them at a high enough price that you can take all of that extra money and invest it in an even more accelerated program of energy efficiency and renewable energy research, development and deployment, so that you have the capacity to then bring the price down to an even greater extent in future years.
Okay.
And so just to give an example, let's say that you sell an extra kind of million units in 1 year beyond what you mean to, then you take that money and you use it to build wind farms and concentrated solar power stations in order to reduce demand by not just that amount, but even more than that amount. And I think you should probably double it as a rule of thumb, so that you're getting a greater benefit in future carbon emissions reductions than the loss that you are making by selling those extra permits that you didn't really want to. So overall, you're bringing emissions down faster, not necessarily immediately in year one, but once you start going through, say, to years 2, 3, 4, and 5, and 6, by which time those additional funds have been invested and are starting to reduce carbon emissions, you end up with a more sharply declining emissions trajectory than you would have done without having this ceiling price.
This is just something I'd like you to clear up, really. Will there be a tradable market in CO2 pollution permits under Kyoto 2?
Yes.
So it's not, there's more than a straight auction, there's also a market.
There is a straight auction and there is also a secondary market.
So once people have bought their permits, they can trade them?
Yeah.
Okay. What would be the advantage in having this, or
one
the point of that secondary market? I mean, I guess you can't avoid it because people, once they've bought them, they have the right to buy or sell them, I guess. You could outlaw it, perhaps?
There's no benefit in outlawing it. But first, let's look at the situation, for example, of a big fossil fuel company, which is going to have to buy a lot of permits. It's very hard for them to know in advance the exact number of permits that they are going to need. So they can take a guess, but at the end of it, they'll probably buy some permits too many or some permits too few. And if they bought too few, then they'll need to buy some more. And if they haven't bought enough, or if they bought too many, then they will sell off the surplus ones, which they own. And so I think from that point of view, it's simply necessary to have that kind of aftermarket. And the other factor is that auctions work best when you have a great many participants. If you've only got a relatively small number of participants, for example, or the world's big fossil fuel companies, if they're the only people participating in the auction, then it becomes a relatively straightforward process for them to try and rig that auction in order to reduce prices. And in reducing the prices that they are paying to reduce the amount of money going into developing solutions to climate change. So the best way, and this is actually standard auction theory, the best way of preventing collusion in the market intended to drive down the price or rig the price generally is to have the widest possible participation. And so an important part of this is actually to encourage as many people as possible and as many companies and organizations and investors and speculators, just as many people as possible to be bidding in this market, to be participating in this market and trading in this market.
Okay.
Because that is how auctions work best, and it's also how markets work best.
So I think a lot of people would feel worried that you had big investment banks and speculative trading in these credits, bearing in mind where we are with the current kind of credit crunch and banking crisis, which has been a result of this kind of speculative investment bank trading.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the credit crunch, that has been the result of speculative trading in highly abstruse and, in many cases, fraudulent securities. And I think that's actually what we've got much more in the case of the existing Kyoto process that we were talking about before and the flexibility mechanisms, where you are trading in carbon securities which are not what they claim to be. In this case, I think the market would be much more like the market that we now have in allowances under the European Union's emissions trading system. And that is now a relatively orderly market and one which operates at least reasonably well. But it operates without the benefit of either a reserve price or a ceiling price. And I think that having a reserve price and a ceiling price actually takes away quite a large part of the speculative element by keeping the trading within a particular range defined by the floor.
Okay, so you would regulate the secondary market with the floor and ceiling price as well?
Wouldn't actually regulate it, but what you would do is you would say at any point in time, anybody can buy permits at the ceiling price, and at any point in time, they can sell permits. This is to the carbon authority. They can sell permits at the reserve price. And so if there's a surplus in the market, they can never drop down below the reserve price, and if there's a shortage in the market, they can never rise up above the ceiling price. And so trading then takes place within this band. And although there is certainly the potential for profit and loss to be made by trading in these permits, the idea is that the overwhelming majority of the benefit goes not to traders and speculators, but to the carbon authority.
Whilst I'm on my queries about the scheme, I'm wondering how difficult it is to police in terms of pollution at source, and whether in fact there is some potential for fraud in that policing. You know, is there the opportunity for bribery, adjusting, tampering with measurement instruments, and false reporting?
There is always a potential for fraud, but in going upstream, you are minimising that potential for fraud by going to the places where the flows of fossil fuels are most easily and most accurately measured. It's far harder to commit fraud or simply make mistakes by going upstream than it is by looking at the point where emissions come out of chimneys and exhaust pipes. And I think a good model for this is the system of duty which is levied on alcohol in the United Kingdom, where the duty is levied upstream and you have bonded warehouses in which you have bottles of whiskey on which duty has not been paid, and when they leave that bonded warehouse and go out into the general market, the duty has to be paid as they leave that bonded warehouse. And so, in effect, you would be doing the same thing with fossil fuels. Now, but does this mean that you never get a bottle of dodgy whiskey on which duty hasn't been paid coming to the market in the United Kingdom? Probably you sometimes do, but not very often, and you certainly wouldn't be buying it in your local supermarket. It's a good system, it's one that works well, and I think you will always have some fraud. What you're aiming to do is to keep it down to the kind of level where it is not a significant problem, and I think we can do that.
How is the policing done? It's some combination of national governments and international officers?
The way I propose doing it is that national governments are responsible for policing within their own country.
But they have an interest in presumably maximising the sales?
Well, yes. What you would do is you would pay national governments a commission on the permits that they raise within their jurisdictions. And so that would mean that national governments, in enforcing this system, have an incentive to do a good job because they get rewarded for doing a good job. They would also be subject to oversight from the Climate Convention or the World Carbon Authority in order to make sure that they do a good job. And if you had a particular country which was clearly not doing a good job, then they could, I suppose, ultimately be struck out of the system. But the key thing here is that you're rewarding the countries that do a good job, and national governments can use it as a source of national revenue. And so in the book I suggest that something like 5% of the value of permits could go to national governments in order to pay their costs of administering the system within their territories and as a reward for doing a good job. And against that sum, considerable penalties would be taken away if it appeared that they were not doing a good job and that they were permitting fraud to take place. So in that way, I think you can have a fairly tight system.
James Hansen has pointed out the importance of phasing out the use of coal entirely as soon as possible. How would Kyoto 2 affect coal?
Well, I think Hansen is right. We want the great majority of the carbon that is contained within coal to stay underground and never make it out into the atmosphere. So there are two ways of doing that. One of them is by simply not mining coal in the first place. The other way is by moving to carbon capture and storage. And I think that there probably is at least some potential for carbon capture and storage in which you're taking the carbon dioxide out of power station chimneys and concentrating it and piping it underground into, for example, deep saline aquifers. This has at least some potential for the future, and I think that under a Kyoto 2-like regime, quite a lot of carbon capture and storage will take place. And this actually has a benefit for the coal producers. It means that they can carry on selling coal for the time being, and in fact, the coal used by a carbon capture and storage power station goes up by about, I think, 20 or 25% relative to one without. And so it actually means that at least in the short term, there is a benefit for coal producers who will be selling more coal with carbon capture and storage rather than less. However, in my opinion, this is only a temporary state. I think it's a way for the coal industry to carry on. It is a way to sustain the economies of coal-producing countries. It's a way for us to carry on generating power from coal. But in the longer term, I think that renewable energy sources will become cheaper and will ultimately take over. So carbon capture and storage has only an intermediate role before we move the entire world onto a renewable electricity infrastructure.
Are you somebody that is a regular attender at the UN talks?
I've not yet been to one, but I'm planning on going to the talks in Poznan.
Do you have any sense of what the negotiators feel about, firstly, the major problems with the current system and the fact that just continuing on with the Kyoto 1 style system just isn't really going to deliver the full solution that we need?
Well, I don't really know because I haven't been yet, and I could probably answer that question better once I get back. But my guess is that they are probably locked so deeply into the whole mental framework of the current negotiating structure that it's very hard for them to break out of that, and that probably among the negotiators a kind of tunnel vision syndrome has developed of not being able to see beyond the bounds of the system which has been created by the Kyoto Protocol. And so part of my intention in going to Poznan is simply to try and get across to the delegates and other participants that there is another way of doing it which has the potential of being far more effective.
If I can quote from your book, you talk about formidable obstacles, the institutional momentum, political capital, entrenched mindset and economic vested interests that are accreted around the Kyoto Protocol. There's a lot been invested in that way of working.
I could have put that better myself.
If people do start to recognise that continuing on with the current framework isn't going to work and they start to look at alternatives, do you think Kyoto 2 has more or less likelihood of achieving a political consensus from all the countries involved compared to contraction convergence, for example?
Compared to contraction convergence? Well, I have no idea of how much contraction convergence has acquired among climate negotiators. I know that there's quite a lot of people have signed up to the idea.
I mean, there's talk, for example, of Angela Merkel being supportive.
Yep, maybe. Personally, I would very much support a situation where the negotiations were really opened up to new thinking, including contraction and convergence, including Kyoto 2, including greenhouse development rights, including a kind of global cap and share system. I think that there's a lot of ideas out there, and I think that actually one of the best things that could come out of this negotiating process that is now underway is if proper consideration was given to a number of different ideas that are out there, all of which I think have got something useful to offer. And it's in this way, by actually opening up the whole negotiation to new ideas and new possibilities, that progress can be made. And I very much hope that takes place, and I'll be very happy to argue my case along with the proponents of contraction and convergence and indeed other solutions.
And in terms of opposition from countries with large fossil fuel reserves that would have an interest in opposing these schemes, what is your response to those countries?
Well, I think my response is, if you look at oil and the kind of oil prices that we've got at the moment, having in effect a production tax on oil at the kind of level of $5 per barrel is not really a problem to them. I think that they would think, gosh, well, if the worst that we face is to have to pay something along the lines of $5 or $10 a barrel when our production costs are $5 a barrel and our sales price is, whatever it is now, I don't know, $60, $70 a barrel, I think that they can afford to pay that, and they will probably just shrug their shoulders and think, well, we can live with that because we're still making plenty of money. In the case of coal, where profit margins are slimmer, I think that the benefit there will come in the short term out of carbon capture and storage, which has the potential to mean that the world's coal burn goes up, at least in the short term. and that if you do a sort of net present value analysis by adding up and discounting future revenues from coal, carbon capture and storage actually has the ability to give a short-term boost over years not very far in the future, say the next 20 years, which will actually add to the net present value of coal reserves more than the fact that after 50 years, we don't want to be producing any coal at all, because anything happening 40, 50 years or beyond actually is worth next to nothing in a net present value calculation. So I think that what carbon capture and storage offers here is the, you know, is that coal-producing countries can actually see the net present value of their coal reserves increasing rather than decreasing, even though coal production could stop completely by mid-century or so.
How might Kyoto 2 actually happen? You envisage at one point in the book that if you don't get global acceptance at the UN talks, for example, individual countries still might sign up to it on a country-by-country basis. Is that plausible, and are there any kind of problems with doing it on a kind of partial basis like that?
Well, I think it's improbable that the entire world will sign up to it all at once. I think it probably has to be driven by specific countries and regions who do sign up to it and who can then bring others along with them. Now, one way in which it could work is that the European Union's emissions trading system, which is already several times bigger than the market created by the Kyoto Protocol itself, the EU ETS is already moving in the direction of Kyoto 2 with auctioned allowances, moving towards 100% auctioning, and with a lot of people, and especially the European Parliament, very keen on having the recycling of revenues from the sale of allowances into solutions to climate change, including assistance to developing countries. In America, the president-elect Barack Obama has a similar policy. He wants to 100% auction permits within a United States greenhouse gas system and to recycle those revenues in the same way, but mainly into delivering renewable energy solutions and bringing about America's own renewable energy revolution. So what we're seeing there is a convergence of thought at a national level and at an EU level, much more towards a Kyoto 2 type system. Now, these different systems that then have the potential to meld together, and other countries will probably want to come on board that are also concerned about greenhouse gas emissions. And then once the money is actually there, once the money is being generated through this system, I think you will then find developing countries wanting to come on board, because the benefit to them from coming on board is that they will have access to these development funds to finance their own renewable energy revolutions and help them with climate adaptation costs. So, yes, I mean, I think that this is the most probable way in which it will come about.
I notice in terms of the non-market solutions that you are proposing, one is to end subsidies for fossil fuel production, which I presume there could be an international push for anyway, as a kind of separate thing. The estimate of annual subsidies to fossil fuel production is in the region of $200 to $300 billion a year. So clearly, if we're trying to decarbonise our economy as rapidly as possible, we should be ending those subsidies as soon as possible.
That is indeed an important aspect. It does not really make very much sense to be creating a carbon cost on the one side, using a carbon price as one of our mechanisms for driving change, at the same time as it's being undermined by carbon subsidies.
You talk about energy labelling and energy efficiency standards for cars, appliances and goods, and this is something that Alice Bowes, for example, was suggesting would be very useful last week on the programme. How much of these non-market solutions have to be applied at the individual country level, and how much of it is possible to legislate for at the international level? I mean, in between that, of course, you have country blocks like the EU where those types of efficiency standards could be applied relatively easily.
I think that what we need to do is to internationalise the kind of standards which already exist in the European Union. But we need to recognise that there is a cost to doing that, and that developed countries in particular can't immediately reach the same kind of standards that we can meet in the European Union. And so we need to support those countries in making the transition and in defining similar kinds of standards for goods that we have here. Ultimately, I think that we do want the same standards to apply in all countries. And part of the reason for that is that actually most of the benefit from this goes to the consumer. And, you know, if you think of someone in a poor country buying a light bulb, they are much better off if they buy a light bulb which burns a fifth of the electricity of the one that they've got. And ultimately they will save money by doing that. But what you have to recognise is that that poor person probably doesn't have the cash in his pocket to buy that more efficient light bulb. And therefore what you have to do is to finance the change so that the costs of developing countries are actually compensated. But in the longer run, you're in fact generating considerable benefits in those countries, and everybody ends up being better off. And if you look at the question of manufacturing, it's actually probably easier for manufacturers to have a single global efficiency standard than it is to be operating to a number of different standards in different countries. And in general, having at least a minimum standard applying at a global level will tend to ratchet up the performance of manufacturers at the same time as reducing their compliance costs.
Then the final point then, it's about the impact of a reducing carbon cap on the economy, and whether the reducing carbon caps to deliver this climate stability implies some kind of recession and an end to traditional economic growth.
Well, the whole kind of purpose of the three elements working together, and just to recap, those are the carbon price, the spending measures, and the direct regulation. The whole idea of this is that you can actually achieve your cuts in emissions without the necessity of a painfully high carbon price. So what I'm looking at here is a situation where, to begin with, your carbon cap is not making deep inroads into emissions, but what it is doing is, through the spending process, it's delivering a lot of money into building, for example, renewable energy infrastructure, and then that means that in years to come you can ramp down your emissions cap quite hard, quite fast, as all that time your investments are paying off in terms of renewable energy production. So it means that actually you avoid economic pain and you avoid individual hardship by never having a very high carbon price. What you're also doing is you are insulating the world and the global economy from the possibility of a recurrence of these extraordinarily high oil prices, which we have recently experienced, going up to over $140 a barrel. That has caused severe economic pain, and many people think that's actually an important ingredient in causing the recession that the world is now going through. So by developing large-scale renewable energy, by using energy more efficiently, you're actually making it much harder for that kind of energy price shock ever to take place in the future. And so you're protecting the global economy for the long term and actually increasing prosperity. And because so much of your energy expenditures, both in efficiency and in renewable energy production, are oriented at poor countries and at poor people, you're also stimulating demand by making those people better off and better able to participate in global markets and enjoy the benefits of industrial production, which many people are presently closed off from because they simply cannot afford to buy the things that they want. So in fact, the net vision that I have of Kyoto 2 is that far from creating recession, which is after all what we have already now with the existing economic framework, is that it will give a considerable boost to the global economy and make the future global economy much better able to withstand economic shocks and relatively immune to hikes in the prices of fossil fuels.
You've been listening to Oliver Tickell, architect of the Kyoto 2 proposal for a new global climate deal, on a special supplement to the usual weekly 300 to 350 show. You can find out more about Oliver's Kyoto 2 proposal by visiting his website at kyoto2.org or by reading his book, Kyoto 2, How to Manage the Global Greenhouse, published by Zed Books. Thanks for listening.